Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
But dude averages 18 yards after catch.
We get it. When you're passionate about something, you go all in. You live entirely in that world. That's exactly how Graybar is about renewable energy projects.
He's all fourth quarter, such a sleeper.
Join our league of clean energy at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Welcome back, folks. We are attempting to connect up with Joan Alker, Executive Director of the Center for Children and Families and a research professor at the Georgetown McCourt School of Public Policy. They issued a new study about Medicaid and how it plays a big role in providing health care coverage, especially to people in rural and small towns, than it does in metro areas. This is important because as a new administration comes in to office, there are congressional leaders, predominantly Republican, well, I should say mostly Republican, that are talking about cuts to Medicaid. In fact, just last week, there was a leak of a report that there is consideration of $2.3 trillion in Medicaid cuts, and that equates to about one-third of Medicaid spending. You will recall that Medicaid's a health insurance program that protects families and people from exposure to high medical costs. It's actually a very lean program, and the reason I know this, after having served on a hospital board in excess of 20 years, it was always a struggle to figure out how to make money on both Medicaid and Medicare population, your mix of your patients that come in as opposed to commercial payers was always a challenge. In trying to create that balance in order to make the numbers that you needed to make. Whether you're a for-profit or not-for-profit, a lot of folks get confused about that. You need to make money on operations because those dollars that you make on operations allow you to get the latest and greatest as it relates to equipment, machinery, and otherwise. With some of the more complex surgeries, dealing with cancers and things of that nature in our respective hospitals, and it's very, very important. The report goes into a lot of data about the utilizers of Medicaid, and also some downstream implications of what has happened in both states that have not expanded Medicaid and even in states that have expanded Medicaid. And you would be surprised to learn that obstetrics is one of those services that is on the decline. And so let's take a break. We'll try and hook up with Joan Alker again, and we'll come back and we'll flesh out some of these details when we're able to get her. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
The search for truth never ends. Introducing June's Journey, a hidden object mobile game with a captivating story. Connect with friends, explore the roaring 20s, and enjoy thrilling activities and challenges while supporting environmental causes. After 7 years, the adventure continues with our immersive travels feature. Explore distant cultures and engage in exciting experiences. There's always something new to discover. Are you ready? Download June's Journey now on Android or iOS.
Whether you want to
buy, buy, buy.
In a bear market or
sell, sell, sell
in a bull market, Jim Cramer can help you become a better investor. Mad Money, weeknights 6 Eastern. Listen to CNBC on the Odyssey app.
Welcome back, folks. We're having difficulty in hooking up with Joan Alker. Obviously, we had a little bit of a failure to communicate. They're on Eastern Standard Time. We're on Central Standard Time. And it seems as though we may not have the time zones that have aligned. You've heard me talk about the federal bureaucracy and they're working remotely. And it's been recently reported that only about 10% of the workforce, about 228,000 employees, never show up at the office. And according to a recent report by the House Oversight Committee, another 1.1 million employees are designated as eligible for telework, and nearly all of them take advantage of it. The average federal employees working 2 days a week from somewhere other than their official work sites. Nearly a third of the Health and Human Services employees are full-time remote workers. Meanwhile, 55% of the Education Department has never set foot in the office, according to the report. And those that telework still end up spending more than half their time out of the office. And to make matters worse, in this lame duck period, but the Biden administration has been pushing back on the data, telling lawmakers that the employees show up every day. That is not the case. And what happens is they have had the GSA, the Government Services or GSO, a services organization, look at this as it relates to utility bills, this, that, and otherwise, to determine whether or not people are actually there. So the federal civilian workforce is about 2.28 million. And as we said, some 228,000 are never required to show up. So it's significant numbers. But this is the long and short of it. In an attempt to beat back on DOGE, the Department of Governmental Efficiency, the Biden administration has entered into agreements with any number of unions, government unions, to memorialize their right to not go to work and to work from home. So there's, I guess, more than one way to skin a cat, and congratulations to Senator Joni Ernst, who quietly was able to have a provision put in the Water Resources Development Act of 2024 to have the GSA, the General Services Administration, sell off a building, the Wilbur J. Cohen Federal Building, a facility that has 2% occupancy. Yes, 2% occupancy. This is a big building, too, right? And she's led the effort in doing this. And what we're finding out is that there are a number of buildings that are out there that are not being utilized. This building that will be closed is 1.2 million square feet. It has the capacity of holding 3,431 people. Hold on to your seats. From January to September of 2023, the average attendance daily in that building, 72. It's capable of 3,431. 72 people have been showing up. The building was constructed during the New Deal. It used to house the Social Security Administration. Now it's only home to the U.S. Agency for Global Media, Voice of America, and a couple of other small government organizations. The interesting thing here is that when you begin to add up the maintenance, in many cases we're leasing federal buildings, and then we have to pay for the energy on top of it, you're talking in the neighborhood of $16 to $17 billion in dealing with these buildings that nobody's going to. Nobody's showing up. You know, we kind of evaluate things in the federal government of, oh, well, it's only $50 billion. That's not that much as it relates to our overall budget, so we don't need to focus on that. No, you need to focus on everything, because once you begin focusing on it a little here, a little there, a little here, a little there, the numbers add up and they become pretty significant in a very short period of time. This one building will save $1 billion over a 10-year period of time. And that's not even considering what they may be able to sell that building for. So hopefully there's any number of ways to skin the cat, and that DOGE can be implemented in a number of these congressional measures as we as they work with the Government Services Administration to determine the utilization of these assets. They're costing you money to keep them alive and well. The worst thing you can do is shut a building down, shut the infrastructure down, you know, water, heat, air conditioning, HVAC, and others, because then the building just gets into complete and total disrepair. So the best alternative is to get rid of it. If you don't need it, you're not utilizing it, get rid of it, sell it. And obviously, as these buildings, this one built in the 1930s, 40s, very costly to keep them up and running. So we congratulate Senator Joni Ernst, Republican from Iowa, for quietly scoring that victory. We will, so we are going to, we're continuing to try to get someone from Georgetown to be able to talk about this. We're going to have Tim Temple on tomorrow at noon. And we're going to want to talk about a number of things that are happening in California with their FAIR plan. And we want to probe whether or not these are issues that are here as well. Because the rights that California has given to insurers as an enormous to write more policies in the state and to protect their FAIR plan as they operate that as an insurance company as well on the consumers is very interesting. So as they struggle to settle these claims and moving forward, the losses by the FAIR plan will be charged to the commercial insurance companies who in turn are allowed to pass those costs on to the ratepayers. So over and above, even the ratepayers that were not impacted by this. So what is ultimately going to happen is just to be able to cover the losses of the FAIR plan, everybody's insurance in the state of California is going to go up. A lot of whom are not able to afford fire insurance now. So it's going to be interesting to see how this will ultimately play out because you get in this vicious cycle and you can't break the cycle as you're moving forward, right? And a lot of what's happening is these insurance costs, the escrow funds for many people here in the state of Louisiana is greater than the principal and interest on their homeowners policies. And then to make matters worse, Wall Street thinks that U.S. homes are overpriced, which is not good either. And so with this overvaluation of homes across the country and what happened in COVID, a lot of the math now is not working, right? Especially with rentals and this and that and everything else. And the returns that folks were looking for are not there. There are people that are retreating from this area, and that becomes a problem. And it becomes a much more difficult problem to resolve. We're seeing that with commercial buildings, and now it looks like we may potentially see the same reaction to valuation of homes in this country by Wall Street, that is pushing that proverbial snowball over the ledge, and it will get bigger and bigger and bigger, and who knows where that will end as well. So we have the confluence of a number of different things coming together that are going to be really problematic for homeowners. And as we watch the economy to see where it will ultimately play out as it relates to inflation and everything else, and we know that we have inflationary effects on any number of individual items, cost of construction being one going up each and every year. Bigger problem for those who have tragically lost their homes in California. And you start feeding this monster, you don't get out of this circular routine that's going on here. And this confluence of all of these negative indicators will not bode well for homeowners in the future. So we'll visit with Tim Temple tomorrow at noon, and we'll try to get and unwrap a lot of what's going on here and whether or not this particular event in California, if that's going to be putting any strain on the reinsurers that we heard a lot about as to why insurance costs have gone up and what it could ultimately mean. All right, we're going to get to a break. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We'll be right back. Stay with us. So we'll have Joan Alker join us after the next break, and we appreciate the accommodation for sure. It's a very important subject matter that we in Louisiana should be really concerned with as we move forward. Netanyahu strikes a cautious tone on ceasefires being reported. In fact, he's canceled meetings with the cabinet vote, blames Hamas for reneging. We spent time talking to Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst, about the possibility of that. Hamas is known to change the terms and conditions of these deals at the last moment in an attempt to extract more from the Israeli government. There's a jaded view and perspective and you know, fair dealing with Hamas. They don't have a history of doing so. So it's going to be interesting to see how this ultimately plays out. At the same time, Bibi Netanyahu is trying to keep his government together and trying to convince his right-wing base that that they all need to come together, and try to accomplish something here. Obviously, there's a lot of pressure in the release of the hostages. We have two American hostages that hadn't really been talked about much that are still held there by Hamas in Gaza. And they were slated to be two of the first to be released as a result of this deal. So it's going to be interesting to see whether or not they're able to consummate the first phase. I think there are four phases to this very complex agreement that has been, that's how it's been referred to by officials that have actually negotiated it. And things are subject to change. But remember, the backdrop is this, threat or observation by President-elect Trump that there will be hell to pay if this thing is not resolved by the inauguration day. Well, that time is ticking away. That's Monday, right? And here we are, January 16th. That's January 20th. So there's not a lot of time. It's going to be concerning if this thing continues and plays itself out. There is the possibility that on the 19th, at some time in the late hours of the 19th, that this resolves itself. But obviously, there's a tug of war going back and forth. Not a lot of appetite by many in Israel to approve this deal. And hopefully, they're able to get something done. I don't know what hell to be paid for is going to look like. The existential threat in the Middle East for everyone, meaning the allies of the U.S., is Iran. Their nuclear capabilities, obviously. They are probably, as was pointed out by Jeff McCausland, in a position right now that they haven't been in quite a while. They're weak. Their government is weak. Their economy's weak. There's a lot of unrest in society in Iran. Their autocratic approach, trying to hold all of this together there, is being strained. The Syrian situation obviously doesn't help their situation. The elimination of many of the Hezbollah leaders as well as the Hamas leaders, the taking over of areas of Samaria and Judea, which the Palestinians want to refer to as the West Bank. Israel has expanded in that area. So it's the confluence of a number of things that are coming to a head, which makes a lot of people curious about where the Trump administration, and what do they mean by there's going to be hell to be paid. There are a lot of folks that believe that unless there's some side agreement of those Arab nations that are helping facilitate this, specifically Saudi Arabia and others, that there's some kind of situation where we come to grips with Iran now, this would all be a waste of time. And if you allow them to regroup, to recollect, re-engineer their approach, try to reestablish their economy, go dark for a while, meaning the Iranians, and trying to pull things together, and then reemerge, resurface, and begin to fund and finance terror across the Middle East. And of course, they are only interested in killing Americans. Terror here as well, that we are bidding against ourselves, and this doesn't make any sense. We'll continue to provide updates as it relates to the most recent happenings by the Israeli government. But it looks like for now, Netanyahu strikes this cautious tone, and they are not moving forward with this agreement at the present time. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. We do have Joan Alker, Executive Director of the Center for Children and Families and a research professor at the Georgetown McCourt School of Public Policy, to talk about a new study released by them relative to Medicaid and the disproportionate impact that any cuts in Medicaid would have in the rural areas as opposed to the urban areas. Joan, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Sorry for the confusion. Joan, your most recent report really caught my eye. I spent over 20 years on the board of one of the largest hospitals in the New Orleans area, and I know how delicate the balance is of Medicaid payments, Medicare, trying to make a return on that to be able to fund capital improvements in the organization. But I also recognize, and I am a Republican, and I was one of the few that supported Medicaid expansion in Louisiana, because I recognize the importance to the delivery of health care for so many folks, especially in Louisiana. Our utilization relative to Medicaid is a big, big number. So tell us about, I understand there was a report that was leaked out of inside the Beltway about Republicans considering a $2.3 trillion cut, which is, I think, a third of Medicaid spending by this government.
That's right. Those numbers were leaked last week, and House Republicans, who are right now paving the way for a big bill, appear to have Medicaid as their top target for funding cuts to finance that bill, which, you know, of course, will give tax cuts that will disproportionately benefit the wealthy. So this is troubling. As you well know, Medicaid is really the backbone of the healthcare system in many ways, especially in a state like Louisiana. And children, the majority of children in Louisiana are covered by Medicaid, and seniors also rely on Medicaid for the majority of nursing home residents. So Medicaid's playing a lot of roles, and these kinds of cuts would be devastating, especially for Louisiana.
There is a misnomer out there that people on Medicaid are non-working individuals. That's not true, is it?
No, that's not true. Well, first of all, the largest single group of folks on Medicaid are children. And in Louisiana, children in rural areas, about 58% of them are covered by Medicaid. But in urban areas as well, 52% are covered by Medicaid. So children are the largest group of folks. We have people with disabilities, seniors and nursing homes, low-income seniors who are getting their Medicare cost share paid. And then with respect to the adults, the majority of adults are actually working. And some of them are just not offered coverage by their low-wage employers. And that's sort of the rub here. You know, these folks are going to have healthcare needs, and that's not going to change. And but what's going to shift is that costs are going to get shifted onto people as services are cut, and hospitals and providers. And particularly for rural areas, hospitals have very thin margins. So there's a lot at stake here.
Absolutely. And the worst thing that can happen is that they walk into the ER, right? Because hospitals having to deal with uncompensated care there is a huge number. And in many cases, a number that hospitals can't recover from.
Well, that's exactly right. And you know, people's needs don't go away. And when you think about how do we want our healthcare system to run, we want folks to be able to get primary care, preventive care. And, you know, you can see this with children who commonly have asthma. And if they're not able to get their prescriptions and get into those doctor visits, their asthma quickly can become unchecked. They wind up in the emergency room. And not only is that more expensive, but they miss school and then they fall behind. So we know that Medicaid for kids is a good investment, but for adults as well. We don't want adults with chronic conditions like hypertension and depression and diabetes access to the primary care they need so that they don't wind up in the emergency room.
Joan, I watched the little over an hour webinar that y'all had last evening, and I knew that hospitals across the country were closing obstetric services, labor, and delivery, but I had no idea to the extent, and I was really surprised, actually kind of mortified, by these numbers. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, this is a real and growing problem that we're seeing across the country. You know, what happens is because there are a lot of fixed costs to providing services for births, you know, you need to have the doctors in place, you need to have the equipment in place to deal with infants, and particularly in these rural communities, we're finding that women are having to go further and further to give birth, and that's a huge problem, and further to get prenatal care, which is another piece of the puzzle, right? That's another very sound use of taxpayer dollars, is ensuring that pregnant women get the care they need. So we really have serious problems in this country. We have a lot of high rates of maternal mortality. And Medicaid, cutting Medicaid is going to make that worse. Medicaid alone is not going to solve all these problems, but cutting Medicaid, which is the single largest payer for births, is going to exacerbate what's already a very difficult situation, especially in rural communities.
I was moved by this number from 2010 to 2022. 238 rural hospitals closed obstetrics, and which represented about 52%. And in the urban areas, 299, which is about 34%, closed their obstetric services being offered as well. What happens? I mean, obviously they're going to another institution, but that means someone is taking it on, and in some cases you can make money on that. Now, I mean, the reason they closed it is because they can't afford to provide these services. But what happens to where they ultimately end up? Doesn't that just exacerbate the problem? And we're facing the potential closure of services being provided in those hospitals, but worse yet, maybe even the closure of the hospital.
That's right. And, you know, this is one of the extra challenges that rural areas face. And they exist in urban areas as well, but the numbers you mentioned show a disproportionate number of hospitals closing their obstetric services in rural areas. And we know that we have provider shortages in rural areas. That makes it difficult for families surmount the transportation burdens, to be able to get to the prenatal care they need, as well as, you know, forbid there's an emergency with the delivery. So this is life and death consequences. And again, with Medicaid being the number one payer for birth, this is one of the questions that's very, very scary as Congress puts Medicaid number one on the list. And, you know, I want to say this issue was not discussed during the election. Nobody voted for this. There was a lot of discussion by President-elect Trump about protecting health care and Medicare and Social Security, but he didn't mention Medicaid. And but he clearly said he wanted to protect health care. So we need to really talk about these issues, the important role that Medicaid is playing, because a lot of times it doesn't break into the discourse, but it is so vital for children, babies, pregnant women, and, of course, seniors in nursing homes. So the full cycle of life is impacted by Medicaid.
Well, when we think about something, and I'm going to put you on the spot here, and you don't have to answer, but I mean, $2.3 trillion in cuts, a third of the spending in Medicaid, and you are familiar with the numbers in Louisiana. On a scale from 1 to 10, 10 being bad, where would you put this particular congressional action, and where would you put Louisiana as it relates to it and what they would suffer as it relates to potential cuts?
Yeah, I would put Louisiana very, very high on the list of being at risk. What we found in our study, there are six states in the country that have half of children living in rural areas who are covered by Medicaid, and Louisiana comes in second in the country there. And, of course, you have the majority of children in metro areas covered by Medicaid as well. So Louisiana has a great deal at stake in this debate.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. Obviously, it was a Democratic governor that expanded Medicaid with some Republican support, but not much. And as I said earlier, because of my experience of sitting on a hospital board, I recognize the importance the same. And what kind of exacerbates our problem here, Joan, is that we take these UCC numbers, the uncompensated care numbers of people showing up in the ER without insurance and otherwise, and the federal government matches that. It goes to the state, and the state has used that number to help finance. We don't get anything back. So if we were to certify, let's just say $100 million just to make it easy, we would get nothing back. And in fact, most of the match that would come back would go to the rurals. And that's one of the ways that we've kept the rurals funded. I won't say adequately funded. I would just say funded. And we've not had to close a hospital yet in Louisiana. But I suspect that if we had to suffer the consequence of that kind of cut, there would be a lot of rural hospitals in Louisiana dropping off, which would be tragic, right?
That's right. And when you look at states that have expanded Medicaid to adults, and most have, there are only 10 states that haven't, you certainly already see more rural hospital closures in states that have not expanded Medicaid to adults. So these cuts are going to have enormous consequences. And the bottom line is, look, we have a cost problem in our healthcare system. It's not a Medicaid problem per se. It's in our healthcare system more broadly. We're paying too much for prescription drugs. We need to bring those costs down. But that's a systemic problem, and we certainly should not be taking all of the money out of the lowest payer in the system in most cases, and the payer that is serving the most vulnerable people and communities, like rural communities, like children, like seniors who need long-term care. So that's the problem here. We want Congress to address these high costs that people are facing and employers are facing in healthcare, but this is not the right way to do that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us and making the accommodation. We truly appreciate it. We know you're busy. We appreciate your time, your insight. Joan Alker, Executive Director of the Center for Children and Families and a research professor at the Georgetown McCourt School of Public Policy. Have a great weekend. Thank you so much. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us.